Kimberly here. This is Macabish, Cults, Classics, and Horrors. We're talking films, series, books, and life. We're starting right now.
Hello, Kimberly. Hello, Chris.
Hello. Pleasure to meet you.
I was telling Chris that up until 5 minutes before he signed in, I was still watching your stuff. Like, It has been a whirlwind marathon. Like, I didn't realize you had, like, 122 credits. And I'm okay, we're going to do it.
You didn't have to do all that. That's why I sent you the link so you could just watch the good shit. I was like, oh.
No, I did. I watched that, too.
That's very impressive. I am already charmed by the amount of media that you want to consume. That's lovely.
How long have you been in the film industry?
I've been working in LA for, I think, about 10 years, and I was kind of doing some freelance stuff in Arizona when I got out of film school there for a couple years prior, so like 12 to 13 years-ish.
Oh, wow. Okay. What made you want to be in the film industry?
I always wanted to make movies, man. When I was a kid, my mom found at a yard sale like these two like broken video cameras, and like one could record and one could play back. And so like she gave them to me, and I would like record movies with one, and then I would like have to take the tape out and put it in the other one to play back and like see what I did. And then so I was like making movies with like my action figures when I was a kid, and then that evolved into making like little kind of short goofy videos with my friends. And then when like the time for college came around, I kind of realized that film school was actually an option, and that it didn't have to just be a thing for fun, that it could be like an actual job.
That's awesome.
Very good.
What was your first job out of film school?
The day that I graduated, I went to a semi-truck company. It was like the one good thing that my college did was like set me up with like an interview, basically. Oh. And they had a sales lot, and they were just looking for somebody to shoot commercials for them. So the day I graduated, I like left the school campus, went to that interview, and booked it, basically. So I spent all summer shooting these like kind of cheesy like semi-truck sales commercials. But it was cool because like it didn't really matter what I charged, because one of those trucks goes for like $80,000. So if like one video I made sold one of them, it would more than cover the cost of having me around. So
sure.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a cool gig. It was fun. It was cool to be able to just like immediately hit the ground running doing what I wanted to do. And then I used I pretty much saved a bunch of that money and then blew it all at the end of the year making my first feature, Run for Your Life. So I kind of spent all of like what I made there on that movie.
That's a dream. Wow. Yeah. You're the first person we've had on that went to film school, graduated, immediately started doing what he wanted to do, and then made the feature. Amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, my dad was a very practical person, and he had spent a lot of his life like kind of doing the jobs that he had to do to make money. So it was deeply ingrained in me that I couldn't really like mess around. Like I was kind of determined to show him that I wasn't like getting into this just to kind of fuck around with a lot of my life. Like I really wanted to like be serious about this and make it a career. So there was a lot of like initial drive, even at like the young age of like, you know, college age, going into school, that I was like, I got to prove that this is a real thing. So I think that was a driving force for a lot of like kind of my early pushing until I got my feet underneath me.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, it can be difficult to sell yourself as being able to survive in like a creative career to people who didn't grow up when that was an option or didn't think that would be an option.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, like to this day, I still don't think they know exactly what I do. I got to have my dad come out actually for Bite the Ground or Bite the Dust. My dad got to come out and be on set for that. And I was like super excited to have him like just hang out for like the big sort of finale like boxing scene, just so he could see me like directing something with a lot of like action and excitement to it. I was like, okay, you can finally see what I've been doing in LA all this time.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And you definitely have an eye for. I was gonna say you definitely have. From what I've only watched the shorts on YouTube, and I found Split Lip on Tubi, so I watched one as well.
Oh,
and
cool.
You definitely have a very solid eye for putting together action sequences.
Thank you.
And a lot of the short and then in Split Lip, a lot of that really. It reminded me a lot of the the stuff coming out of Hong Kong, just the way that it's choreographed and the way that it's shot. And I think that's just, it's fantastic.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you. Yeah. When I was in film school, I read this quote, I think it was on IMDb, and it was about the Punisher film with Thomas Jane. Mm-hmm. And the director of that film had like kind of, you know, the movie didn't have like the best reception. And I loved it when I was a kid, but the director had this quote that he was like, oh, like all we had was like 14 million. I can't make an action film for 14 million. And like, you know, like now I understand what he was saying. Obviously, like the bigger films, the bigger things get, the more money you need. It's a lot more difficult. But as a kid with a bunch of audacity in film school, I was like, shit, I can make an action film for nothing. Mm-hmm. So like I was determined to figure out like how to shoot action and make it look believable. And so that's, we started making these little YouTube short films called Split Lip, when I was in film school, and like they did pretty well for like early YouTube days, as far as like people catching onto them and seeing them, like randos on the internet. And we had so much fun making those. I think we made like a series of them. There's like six on YouTube. And then when I got around to like writing sort of what would be like my first action film, I was like, it has to be that title. Like I got to sort of continue that idea. And the lead of Split Lip, DeRay, who is phenomenal, like a far better actress than I deserve for the price point that I was shooting at. She was a friend of mine from Arizona, and she was actually in some of those online shorts.
Oh, so, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I have to look for those.
Yeah, me too. I forgot about your YouTube channel.
It's okay. No, I sent you the updated stuff. You've got the good ones. You can go back and watch those if you want, but you've seen the best.
Yeah. Welcome to the Sting. The fight scenes, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Those were great. And also, while I was watching it, I realized I haven't seen too many Black people fight like that on TV. And I don't like that.
Yeah,
that was actually
Wesley Snipes.
That was a huge driving force in making that short film. So this was coming off the tail end of the pandemic. It was still kind of going on, but people were coming back to life. And a buddy of mine, Billy Smith, who's the choreographer and my co-producer for that, he played the character who beats the two of the guys up at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he was the older dude.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. He's so much fun to work with. But him and I were supposed to, I had written a feature for the same guys that did the Western for it. It was like a zombie action film. Mm-hmm. And I was just going to go down to Arizona and have a ton of fun making this movie. But then one of their investors dropped out, like, within a couple weeks of our production schedule.
Oh.
Yeah, so it really sucked. And so him and I were both really let down by that, but we really wanted to work together still. So I told him, I was like, would you be down? Like, I'll write something, I'll send it to you. Let's just pool our money together, get some of the people that we were gonna hire for that movie and just go make a short film instead. So I wrote Welcome to the Sting, and like one day I sent it to him, he loved it. We started looking for people, just kind of seeing who was available. We knew James, the lead. We were definitely going to work with James because he was supposed to be in the other film. Then we kind of just pooled our resources and threw it together and made a two-day shoot out of it. And man, it was such a blast. It was such a good energy on set. Like we wrapped, I think like an hour early both days that we were shooting, and still got everything we wanted out of it.
Which
that's
is great.
Like, you know, yeah. If you guys have been on film sets, that's kind of like a unicorn experience. You shoot down to the wire.
All of like it was so complexly put together, and you shot the whole thing in 2 days.
Yeah, you know what's crazy too is so we did it the right way. Like we wanted to kind of do everything the right way, the safe way. So we did 2 days of rehearsal prior, where like the first day everybody gets together. And you see this all the time in LA, like in the parks. Like you'll see like stunt teams just like, you know, kicking the shit out of each other in a park because it's just like, you know, a free space to work. So we went to the park and we had them do like a bunch of rehearsals of all the fight scenes. We worked out a lot of the kinks, and then we came back another day and I brought a camera and we shot previs. So I kind of put the camera in all the places that I would for the short film. So we knew exactly kind of where the hits would sell. But then we get there on the day to shoot, and James, who's very talented and an excellent kicker. If you check out this dude's Instagram, he's throwing these like beautiful, like tornado kicks and stuff. And then on the day, he like pulls a hamstring like three takes in. So like we had just started shooting the fight scene. So and like obviously, you know, your first concern is for his health, right? Because he's obviously a very talented young man and he's got a career ahead of him. So nobody was wanted to be like, get up and do it. So everybody just kind of like froze. And I was like, what's kind of cool is being on a set with a bunch of stunt people is as soon as somebody gets hurt, everybody has an idea of how to help because they've all been hurt.
Of course, yeah.
So yeah, so everybody kind of like they sort of like converged on James, started giving him advice of what to do, and then while that happened, I pulled Billy to the side and I was like, okay, if he wants to continue, if he's feeling crazy, we obviously can't throw big kicks, so we have to change the whole finale of this fight. So what can we do? And so him and I just started like talking through like all the options of like what moves to do. And I had brought that suitcase as just a prop for Billy's character to carry around. And I was like, shit, can he hit him with the suitcase? Billy's like, yeah, that could work. So when James stood back up and was like adamant that we were going to continue, like he would not hear anything else. He's like, no, we're going to do it. We're going to finish this. And then we just reworked the finale. We took out some of the bigger kicks and had him beat him down with the suitcase instead.
That was really good.
Yeah.
Really I didn't cool. know where it was going. In the end, I was like, oh. Why is this just a short? But we know now.
Yeah, so I actually, because the short was so much fun to do, and because it felt like there was so much, so many legs to that story, I actually wrote a show for it. So I have, I have a pitch deck built, and I have a 1 hour pilot episode of that, like of the what would be the series, and I've gotten like maybe 20 pages of like the second episode written, but the whole series is like plotted out on the pitch deck, and it's been sent to a couple of people. I don't think anything that like nobody's like requested it personally, but it's been sent to people who are just like, hey, do you have any like action scripts that are ready to go? And I've kind of sent it off, so it's out there in the world. And you know, the moment that I get to work with a studio, it'll be the first thing I pitch to them for sure.
Awesome.
Very good.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because I agree there are not enough There are a lot of great like black action stars out there that are sort of undiscovered, you know. Mm-hmm. Like everybody knows Michael Jai White, but not a lot of people know, you know. I mean, my Instagram is full of them. I seek them out, and they're over these doing these incredible videos. And yeah, nobody's given them a chance to lead a film yet. So I think that we should see a lot more of that. They're so talented.
Yeah, I think so too. That's the one thing I noticed in your work. There's a lot of diversity. When I was watching your Freddie Van short.
Oh yeah.
I was expecting white people. Like there are no white people in this. Like this is not, I just know it's gonna be good. Let's see it. And man, it was. That lady, I was like, all right, she's gonna have to give us a scream. We need a good scream.
Yeah.
Because I have to narrate everything I watch.
Oh man. Great. I want to watch really my stuff great. While you're watching my stuff. That's great. I want to hear you narrate. He's asleep. Don't trust her.
Right? It was really good. I was like, you know what? We're going to need some more Freddy fan films from this guy. This is great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, that one, it's weird. Like, I had my YouTube was like a big thing for me when I was in school and then my like early career. And then I sort of like, because everything I was making was like larger scale than like a YouTube film, I stopped mm-hmm. kind of like putting stuff on there for a while. And I like lost my connection sort of with my YouTube audience. So now, like, I put shorts out on there sometimes, and I don't really get a huge response. But like, mm-hmm. like every Halloween, that thing jumps like jumps like 1,000 views. But yeah, I was always hoping that one would get in front of more eyes because I had so much fun making that. And Chris, who was the lead of that one, and also you've seen him in a bunch of my other stuff if you watched it.
Yeah, he seems to pop up in pretty much everything.
Yeah, he's a very close friend because he was the lead in my first feature, Run For Your Life. And since then, we've just collaborated and stayed, like, literally stayed very close. He's like my neighbor. He was the driving force behind that one because he loves Nightmare on Elm Street. And he really wanted to make, like, a fun little fan film for it.
Wow.
So I think he wrote the initial script, the initial draft. And then we like to talk through a bunch of ideas of like what we could do without getting a big crew involved or without getting a bunch of money involved, like what special effects we had available to us and like what kind of like camera tricks we could use to like make the claws like fly into his mouth and stuff like that. So yeah, it was cool. It was a fun little like kind of art project together.
Mm-hmm. He's a really solid performer too.
Dude, he's great. He's
yeah,
so
he
good.
Is. It's,
yeah.
In Broken Toys, I think
yeah.
that's the one. He was fantastic.
Oh yeah,
dude, he's a.
I mean,
he's
everybody
a
in that was amazing, but he was just the emotion that he put across. It blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
It was just incredible and completely not what I expected, even like from a, you know, from a obviously micro budget sort of YouTube short. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it's weird to have that one because that film we made it just before, like it got finished just before. The strikes happened. So like in the sort of the window that I would normally be like posting about it, talking about it, putting it out there, sending it to festivals, I was trying to sort of be observant of, you know, the strike etiquette where people weren't really like talking about their work and stuff. So I kind of, it kind of sat on the back burner, like finished. It's like ready, obviously it's ready to be sent to festivals, but it's just kind of hanging out on my hard drive. And then Eichengrau came up. And so now I'm in this like kind of swirl of like promoting one thing where I don't want to like, you know, try to like side promote it. So now I'm just kind of waiting for the new year to start where I can do like a whole fresh push for it and, you know, finally get that out in front of people. But yeah, their work in that is fantastic. And that was another one where basically like I had done a lot of action and a lot of like kind of horror and sci-fi and stuff, but I hadn't gotten a chance to really do a lot of drama. And I know that I love those stories and I love those performances specifically. So I sort of like set aside my time to do two drama shorts kind of back to back with Miss Teen USA and Broken Toys to really like kind of make sure that I could still like connect, you know, with those kind of stories and like write those kind of stories and make sure that what I'm saying in my movies resonates on a human level as much as it does on an entertainment level. And then that way, like when I returned back to doing genre stuff, I wasn't, you know, just doing like the genre justice. I wanted to make sure it was like I could make a movie that could still sit with you when you finish watching it, kind of thing.
Well, sure. I mean, you definitely succeeded with Broken Toys. Like as
yes.
myself, as someone who, you know, suffers with various mental health concerns here and there, it really resonated. And there was a lot of what I forget the character's name, but the other actor Chris, a lot of what he was doing, it really just it. Like I could feel it as he was talking to his girlfriend and as he was sitting, like even the opening when he's sitting in the bathroom and just like outside the shower. And like, I could just feel the, like, I don't know, just that level of depression. And I think like, I've been in that situation. Like I know that feeling and it completely translated from like from my screen into my head. Mm-hmm. So it was incredibly successful doing that. Absolutely.
Amazing. Fantastic. I'm very sorry to hear that you've experienced that, but that is, yeah, it's an extremely common sort of phase of human life that I'm glad that like finally in sort of this era we are openly talking about it all the time. And I think that's like incredibly healthy because yeah, everybody I think hits lows, and some people hit even lower lows because they're not allowed to talk about the casual lows. And yeah, absolutely. So I'm glad that we're talking about it, that we can make art about it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It still has that stigma of, you know, the mental health stigma is still around. It's not as bad as it was even 4 or 5 years ago, but it's still there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's incredible with each sort of like successive generation how much more comfortable sort of we become with being humans. Mm-hmm. Like my niece is I think she's like 11 or 12 and I hear her just spout shit out randomly about mental health. And I'm like, God damn, like it took me to like, you know, the age of fucking 25, 30 to figure that out.
Right.
You're just running around knowing it. Like, this is cool. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. After I watched Broken Toys, Who's Listening, which by the way, the payoff, the end, man, let me tell you something. Those two and the one we're not supposed to be bringing up because it's a secret.
Oh, you can talk about the other one. Okay. You can talk about all of them. I mean, it might be a bit of a tease for the audience because some of this stuff isn't going to be available for a bit. But feel free to talk about it. I mean, you guys got to see it, so
yeah. You're well, the first. I will say they felt like teasers for what my mind wants to believe Eichengrau is going to be, and it actually made me more excited about potentially seeing that movie. So I hope your Indiegogo gets funded so as much as y'all need, because if those shorts are any indication, that's going to be an exciting movie.
Thank you. Yes, they are very much an indication. A lot of those same people are working on the film that I did both of those short films with. And again, the cool thing is like the one of the best parts of my job are the people. Like, you know, a set is always a team environment, and the coolest thing and like kind of my job as a director is to sort of like when everybody gets a set is to capture that part of everybody's mind that is still like the kid that wants to make the cool movie. And so like everybody that I had on those short films, like, you know, I have sort of curated over a time of like working on a bunch of different movies, and you all, like all the kind of the internal kids on set find each other, and you mm-hmm. get excited about things, and you're like, okay, this is the person I want on my next project and so forth. So like everybody that we did those short films with are all sort of bringing that same excitement and energy to Ike and Grau. Wow. And stylistically too, because those were two very different with Here to Stay and Who's Listening. Those are very different horror films. You know, one of them was the more kind of blockbuster, like jump scare, but creepy mm-hmm. style. The other one was more slow build kind of gothic horror. And Ike and Grau has a lot of both in it. So yeah. Yeah, they are very much an indicator of what's to come. So that's, I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed them.
Oh yeah. And Blood in Them Hills, yes. It makes me think of The Hills Have Eyes. Only because Ooh. Of the title. It's nothing to do with the movie, but only
yeah.
because
yeah.
the title is gonna bring the fans of The Hills Have Eyes and all the hillbilly horror to see that movie. At first they're gonna be a little disappointed, but I think it's gonna really change some minds, because mm-hmm. that little teaser, that was good.
Thank you.
I'm really excited about that too. I mean, the disappointment I will feel if that never gets made.
So right? So Blood in Them Hills is done. That one is ready to we're in talks with distribution to sell it, and that's the kind of the main reason that I haven't like posted anything about it, because whenever a distribution company takes over, they do a lot of their own marketing. Sure. So I kind of don't want to, like, I would rather wait to see what their move is and then bolster mm-hmm. their move than like make an early move and, you know, maybe like sully the market before they can get to it. So like, I don't want to post anything about that until they can, you know, because like it's oftentimes like if a distribution company is kind of worth their weight, the first time you see a trailer will be through, you know, like a horror magazine or something that we're sure. familiar with. So I want to make sure that they have a chance to do things the right way with that one. But yeah, that was a crazy production, man. And I want to like, I'm trying, and I'm in sort of like even in early communication with the distribution company to make sure that like the expectations are set where they should be for that one. It is a supernatural horror, mm-hmm. More than it is like, or a supernatural Western more than it is a horror Western, basically. Because right. like, right. yeah, if it was going like full tilt horror, it would have been a different script. It is a lot more like observant of the sort of Western genre mm-hmm. Than it is of the horror, but there are like supernatural elements throughout, basically. But there is right. there's lots of killing and lots of shooting and lots of action, so it is still like a fun movie. I don't want people to expect Hills Have Eyes and then be disappointed, because I'm
not trying but to bait, see that that's
trying to
the
bait
thing.
Switch anybody.
Well, yeah, but like I don't think, especially when it comes to like indie productions, I think people are really coming around to coming expecting one thing and getting something else, and that having that not actually be bad, mm-hmm. right? And also Westerns, mm-hmm. you know, we think about Westerns, we think about like our grandparents, like The Rifleman and Bonanza and all that.
Yeah.
I love that it we are turning it into like Bone Tomahawk. As much as I say, oh, I don't like Western, yeah, I do, because every time I watch Western I like it. Just the old Westerns are too damn long. But I love that they're coming back, because I like them more.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fun to like play in that world, because it's everything in a Western is just so like inherently Western. Like you know, you look through the monitor and you're like, damn, we are actually making a Western. Like this really does feel like, you know, old world. It's mm-hmm. it's cool. Like there's just sort of an amount of like unescapable like pageantry to the whole thing, you know, like there's nothing in front of that lens that doesn't have a costume on, that isn't holding like an old gun. And then like when you talk about the guns, like, you know, we filming shootouts for those movies, and you know, every gun is like firing this like, you know, this like big puff of smoke whenever it shoots, and there's just kind of like a really fun like power to that when you're shooting it. So mm-hmm. they're a good time. Yeah, I never would have anticipated prior to the pandemic, if you told me I would have directed 3 Western features, I'd be like, nah, that ain't me.
Right.
But then here I am, yeah, three deep, and you know, with the same company still has more that they want to do. So we'll see if I end up doing more Westerns after this.
That's pretty cool, because I don't know. I kind of feel like Westerns are going to make a comeback mm-hmm. with
they really have,
generations.
Man. Yeah, they really have. It's surprising like how much Western television is happening right now, you know, from like 1883 and Yellowstone and all that stuff. And then mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the films are cropping up constantly. Yeah, Bite the Dust is what it was called after Distributors bought it. It was originally called Bite the Ground. But that one, we really tried to do something that was very like family friendly comedy adventure, just kind of like almost like not quite to this like production scale, obviously, but something like The Mummy, where like there's like action, but it's like funny and people die, but then there's like a joke afterwards. So like, yeah, we tried to kind of like split the genre a little bit with that one and just make it something like very watchable and like pleasant and
Yeah,
fun.
I like that because it needs, we can bring back something old and make it new and fun again for everyone. I love nostalgia, so people automatically think, well, I want new to be exactly like the old. Well, that's just not so at all. I just want the spirit of it to be the same. I don't want it to be exactly the same. That doesn't make any sense. So I actually kind of get pretty stoked when I see Westerns, especially because I've watched enough film at this point and enough horror that I can tell when somebody makes a Western if they've also made horror or what other genres they've made. And that makes the Western better. It makes it more fun. But I
Yeah,
don't.
people, the studios don't understand that like when people are nostalgic for something, they're not nostalgic for that same thing. They're nostalgic for that same experience.
Right.
They want that magic of when they watch something that was engrossing enough that they believed it. And like as a kid, obviously that door is wide open more often than it is as an adult. You kind of have to do a little bit more work to be able to sit down and really like engross yourself in a film, you know, the older you get, I think. But like that's what good films can do that effortlessly. Good films make that easy, and that's what people are nostalgic for, is that sort of easy entertainment. They're not nostalgic for the same movie again and again. That's ridiculous. Who the
Right.
fuck wants that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are some people, there are some trolls that is what they want. That's why we have Marvel and it's the same movie over and over and over and over again. But the rest of us sane people, we don't want to see the same thing over and over again. That's why I'm such a fan of indie films because that's where you go to dream something else and make it happen. That's where we see something new because we're not going to see anything like really new and like a blockbuster film because, you know, they're spending too much money. We see the new stuff with the low budget indies, and that's what makes them so exciting. Every single one of them. And we want something new as much as they don't think that's true. We do want something new. But
I love that.
I don't think they know what that means. And I don't know what that means. Because it's like we're watching, you see the numbers, you see what we're watching. What are you doing? But I watch indie films, especially indie horrors, because that's where innovation lives. And even if you can tell they only had 10 grand, when it gets to the moment they made the movie for, you know why they made the movie. And it's usually magic. And I
Yeah,
love
that
that.
one great idea that made the whole movie come to life.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what, you know, I spend my time on social media trying to get people to see. Stop looking for $10,000 movies to look like $10 million blockbusters. That's not what they're doing. They are innovating. Let them show you something new and be open to it.
Lean into the things that you don't have and just tell a
Right.
story that you do.
Exactly. Like, that's what makes it exciting. But,
I mean
like,
there's it's really cool when you, 'cause you know the more and more money that you get, the more a sort of money is thrown at something as a solution. And
right.
it's just never it's not necessarily the best way to go about something like film, where you're making art with a bunch of people. So like the best way to find a solution is through creativity, which when you're an indie film, you're forced to do. Like there's no other option. There is no like secret money hoard to be found. You just have to figure it out. Like, oh, we only have this location for this much time, this actor on this day, this actor on that day. We got to make the scene work between them two, and we need this like big blood gag to work. How do we put this all together? And
Right.
you got to kind of like find that creative innovation within yourself and your team to make it work. And I think that's when you end up with these like you said, these like one great ideas, these like really cool, innovative moments.
And I think some of them are also very aspirational, and I really can feel that. I don't know if everybody else can because I watch so many movies. I can see it. And it's like you just know if they could just get that funding and they could get this chance to make this movie again, you can see what it can be. Mm-hmm. And that's just what's so exciting. And so when I find one of those filmmakers, I tend to follow their work for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they're like, oh, well, why did you invite me here? And they don't know I've been stalking them for years.
Amazing.
Because it's exciting. It's exciting to watch them evolve and grow. One of the reasons why I started the podcast, so they can see what we see. We can see the skill. They just need the money. They just need people to believe in them. And we're just like, believe in them. Mm-hmm. You can't see it yet, but it's there. Yeah. And that's why I'm so excited about I Can Growl, which is the question I want to ask next. Where did that, where was the inspiration?
So when I grew up, and we were talking, about mental health earlier. I grew up in a very small town in Arizona. And when I was a kid, I saw a lot of like mental health problems around me. But like as a kid, you don't really like process it. You just kind of soak it up. Mm-hmm. And in an environment like that, especially in like, this was, you know, like post 9/11, early recession, mental health wasn't a thing that people were talking about. It was still a thing that people were sweeping under the rug. And so there was a lot of, I mean, there's kids, you know, people that I went to school with that didn't make it out of that small town that you know, there's people who would come to school every day and I would hear stories about what their parents were doing to them, you know, and it was just like a bad, kind of like, to me, it was like this bubble, this like really bad sort of environment where nobody was sort of like fixing their problems. And I think that like really soaked into me as a kid, and I didn't quite know what to do with those thoughts, but I was like drawing all the time on like sketching in class when I should have been paying attention. And I would constantly sketch like one of the, like a consistent thing over and over again was this like a monster in the corner of the classroom or a monster in the corner of the bedroom. The idea that like there was always like everybody had like a creature that belonged to them. And that idea stuck. I didn't know what to do with it yet, but that idea like was in my head for a long time. And then when I graduated film school, I made my first feature, which was Run for Your Life. And that was like supposed to be me using those ideas. So I went back to my hometown. I shot at the school that I went to. And I brought Chris along, was the lead for that one. And he played a character named William Fall, and who like was experiencing those things, and who had like a doppelganger like creature that was like following him around whenever something terrible was happening in his life. It was like always in the corner of the room staring at him. And so I made that film, but I think that even then in my life, I don't think I was at a point where I was understanding what I was making enough. Like I put those ideas in the movie, but I didn't quite say something about them. There wasn't like a through line. There wasn't a real statement. It was just that those situations exist. Like all the characters in the film had were afflicted by various sort of like mental health problems, and it doesn't end well for any of them. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't necessarily like saying I think what I should have or what I could have or doing what I could have with that kind of raw material that was in my brain. So fast forward, you know, all these years later, I've been making all these other movies, and also just, you know, growing up and like meeting people and learning things and understanding stuff more and going back and like looking at all of that with, you know, the hindsight being 2020 and understanding a lot of that more of like what was actually happening in my life around that time. So then I kind of wanted to reapproach that material and do something a little bit more effective essentially with, you know, these kind of like nightmare visions that I've had since I was a kid. Like, you know, my earliest, like, from when I was a child in my bedroom alone, like thinking of like creepy things that would like, you know, you creep yourself out at night. Like some of those like earliest sort of ideas I'm trying to kind of like mine from my brain and pull into the present and build what is essentially I Can Growl. Mm-hmm. And I Can Growl, the word itself, it means the color of darkness behind your closed eyes. It's a German word,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was like a perfect name for a film about trauma and about these like sort of the main character is played by the same, you know, actor who played William Fall, but it's now like the whole kind of story is updated now. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like he can see the trauma creatures that follow everybody, but he's the only one that can see them. And the more that he gets to know somebody, the more likely he is to start seeing these like horrible creatures that are following everyone, but now the creatures can see him back. And they want something from him. And so he spent a lot of his life running both from his own and from everyone else's. So he's like kind of a loner, forced into being a loner. And he basically, in our film, he comes to a point where he realizes that he can't run anymore, and he needs to like kind of face this and figure out like what is happening, what these things are, and what his is, and like what it means.
I was telling Chris, it reminded me of It Follows.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
But potentially better, maybe. Well, I don't know. Yeah.
It Follows was great. I mean, you like It Follows was that perfect example of like one really, really good idea that like can carry a movie. Like you got one concept that's so simple that you can put it into a sentence, and even just hearing that sentence, you could sit there and debate the circumstances with friends, you know, over and over again. To like, how do you get away from that? You know, that was a very, very clever film for that.
It really was.
Yeah.
Oh, also, Chris and I want to know, are you going to have physical releases? Because we'd like physical releases.
We'd love physical releases. People.
Please?
Oh, should I? Physical releases for which one?
Yeah, everything.
All of them.
All of it.
Everything.
All of it. Anything that is a completed feature, that's got to be in your release contracts. We got to have physical media of these things.
You know, it's funny. I was just talking to the distributor when we were talking about Blood in Them Hills, and he kind of said, he's like, we're not going to do the physical release route through like something like Walmart, but we would probably do like a on demand kind of things. Like if as you buy it, they make it and send it to you. The problem with physical releases these days for indie films is that like there's not like, because it's not a huge money pipeline anymore, there aren't like a lot of great companies that are doing really good transfers, so like the streaming ends up looking better than like the, which I mean, I get that's not like the point, is, you know, like the physical release is kind of just to have it in your library, and I get that because I still have a bunch of Blu-rays and DVDs, but yeah, that's like the one disappointing thing, like because they did Bite the Ground or Bite the Dust was that has a physical release, and so does the first Western I did, Royals Revenge, and both of those like don't look like stellar on the DVD. Yeah, which that's is wild. Yeah. I don't know why that's a thing. I'm assuming because there's not as much money on the indie side in physical. But I know, I agree with you. Anything that I make that's like, especially Eigen Growl, that I think that has to be physical release, because I'm really putting my heart and soul into trying to make somebody's favorite movie there. So I think it needs to be something that, if I'm asking the audience to take ownership of it when they're watching it, then I need to give them the chance to own it in their library. I agree.
That's great. I agree, because that I hate to see amazing movies and they are streaming only, because I own all the, like, they're in my house. All the great movies I love are in my house. I don't like the idea of them not being in my house, because what if I want to see it 2 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday in 2027? I don't know if I'll be able to see it if it's on streaming. I have no idea.
Yeah, there's this new terrifying thing too with like streaming platforms just sort of like turning off the water, you know, just like just taking a show away. Yeah, like I never thought that in my wildest dreams that would be something that they wanted to do or that they would do, is just be like, the show didn't do that well, so we just got rid of it.
Yeah, they just
like, that's crazy.
Stop.
That's hundreds and hundreds of people's like lives and work in that, and you're just gonna like not let audiences see it, and you were the only one that owns it, so nobody else can ever see it. Like, that's insane.
Yeah,
I had a gal I know, she's not like a close friend, just like an acquaintance on social media, but she was in the Pink Ladies show. It was like a big break for her, and they just like eviscerated it. They just took it off the air. Like, that's insane.
It is, and we don't know what to do with that. Like, it's a problem.
Yeah,
and there's nothing we can do about it, because like, what are you gonna do? Copy it ourselves? Well, that's supposed to be illegal. So,
yeah, you told us not to download it, but yet here we are.
Right.
Yeah,
you're taking it away from us, and like, we still want it. So.
Yeah. You know. No. Okay. Like, so I'll take that note. That's a great note. Physical releases. Thank you for yelling at me. That's important.
We'll yell about that for years to come, I'm sure.
Please do.
Just, you know, put it on your Indiegogo campaign, right? Especially if that's the only way we're gonna get it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll buy it. We bought a lot of things just from Indiegogo campaigns, because where else are we going to get it from?
In the horror community, especially, they're like, of all of the different like fandoms, horror loves their physical media.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Okay. Yeah.
I will. We don't mind buying. I will make that update of something we like.
Yeah, and I like
it's very admirable, and I love that. I love that about. I mean, the horror community in general. Like a couple of years ago, I mean, obviously, I was kind of like inherently in it, but a couple of years ago, when I knew that I was going to try to really make my mark in horror, I started really paying attention to the horror community. So I was like going on forums, finding like different like online, you know, groups on Facebook and Reddit and stuff, and just kind of like. Just reading people's opinions, you know, when they weren't feeling like they were being watched by marketing and they were just talking about movies they loved. And I loved it, man. I'm so charmed by it. Like just the way that like somebody can unabashedly go on to, you know, somebody's like, oh, what's your favorite horror movie or favorite guilty pleasure? And somebody will go on and mention a horror movie that came out in like 2008 that I know like isn't a great film. And they're like, that's my favorite shit. Yeah. And I just love that. I love that sort of like bold-faced love of the art form. It's like I said, it's very charming to me, and it makes me really, really committed to, like, I want that audience to be happy. Like, I want to make you guys like the movies and the films that give you that level of like escapism that turns into sort of like pure joy, where you're like, this is my movie. Like, I want to make the movie that, you know, it's got to come from somewhere in my heart, but I want it to belong to you by the time it's done.
That's awesome. See, that's all we want. That's all we want.
Yeah.
That's all we want. Yeah.
And I love, like, I put clips, even though you're not supposed to, because, you know, copyright, but I don't care. I'll take the risk anyway. But I'll put clips on TikTok and stuff. And every once in a while, well, more often than not, I'll go viral. One of my favorite indies, which is Motivational Growth, it went super viral on TikTok. And the filmmaker, Don, he contacted me on TikTok and on Instagram. And we had him here. And he was it blew up. And I made a TikTok account. I went and I looked, and you posted a clip. And I didn't know what was going on. And that's what I like doing. I like finding indie films that I love and being like, look at this. And then sending everybody to wherever it is.
Well, but because you said that, I'm going to watch Motivational Growth now.
You said it's really good.
I just looked it up. They actually they're distributed through the same distributor that my first two films are, so that's cool.
Interesting.
Oh
yeah,
what bothers me about the streaming thing is, you know, if I post a clip and people will go back years and it's like, oh, where can I watch this? Well, it was once available someplace and now it is not. And it's not on physical media. So now they can't watch it at all. And that sucks.
Yeah.
So I know we're fighting a losing battle here with physical media, but like, I like promoting indie films and I want people to be able to see them.
No, and that's a beautiful reason. And I don't necessarily think it's a losing battle. I think that there are these like strange waves of physical, like for instance, I think there was a thing that said that record sales were like up for the first time in a long time. Like, I think there are, like I said, just sort of like waves of love for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And there's like the initial like market craziness, and then things like kind of take a dip. And then once people realize they don't have that thing they love anymore, then they go out and they go for it again. So, yeah, right. I think that it will definitely, especially, I mean, they've already made a couple wrong steps, but maybe only take a few more from streaming before people go crazy again and go back for physical media.
Yeah, there's a lot of anti-streaming sentiment floating around lately.
Yeah streaming companies had a bad year, man. Between canceling shows, too many of the mergers that don't feel like they are in the best interest of the product, raising prices, then there was the strikes. So they've had a horrible PR year, and it's going to be very difficult for them to make a good move going forward. I mean, the first one of them that releases something that's made by AI, they're going to see their platform shut down. Like,
I think everybody
is tasting the corporate stench, you know, on some of the maneuvers, and we want to get back to feeling like we're watching movies made by movie studios and made by people who care.
This is the number one place for macabre cults, classics, and horrors. For synopsis, reviews, and news, go to macabre.com. Thank you for listening. Signing out. Until the next.